White Lotus Society Compound, Fort Tonrock, near Kurluktuk, Southern Water Tribe. Uchna climbed down from Vayu's saddle and stood regarding the torchlit courtyard in which the sky bison had landed. Between the torches and the glorious aurora above, she could see about as well as on an overcast afternoon, well enough that the walls of the fortified compound around them were plainly visible. "So, you have a fortress of solitude," she observed. "I'm not as surprised by this as I might have been." Cora gave a slightly distracted chuckle as she swung down next to her. "Well, for some values of solitude," she allowed. "It's actually the compound where I was trained as a kid. Later on, I took it over as a kind of retreat." She pointed out the massive main gate behind them, and a second, smaller one in the wall off to the left. "Two entrances. The other one leads down to a boat dock off the fjord, but the fjord's frozen this time of year, so it's closed off. Worst comes to worst, the keep at the back is fortified in itself. You guys should be safe here until I can sort out what's what up in Republic City." She glanced at her wrist, where her lens was covered by one of her bracers, then went on. "While I'm at that, it's probably best if you don't try to reach me. I've got to at least try to get some rest on the flight, and once we get into Republic City, I have a feeling I'll be pretty busy for a while." "Sure you don't want any help?" Corbin inquired, handing baggage down to Uchna. "I'm too tapped out right now to window us up there, but at least one of us could go with you." "No," Cora said. "Better you stay together, I think. I've got a weird feeling." She trailed off, looking into the night sky above the compound for a moment, then shook her head, recalling herself to the here and now. With a wry, slightly weary smile, she went on. "I appreciate the offer, I really do. But like I told you back in April, the comet thing isn't your fight. I'll be more comfortable knowing you're all here while I take care of this." Uchna looked unconvinced, but nodded. "Okay, but be careful. If you need us, holler. We'll find a way." "I will," Cora promised. "Either way, I'll let you know when the coast is clear. In the meantime, Maki and Izumi are on their way down from Kyoshi Island. They'll be here in a couple hours. They and the White Lotus people here will look after you, so just chill here for a while, so to speak." With hugs and a few kisses all around, she took her leave of them all, then climbed back up onto Vayu so that Nima could run her back to Hakoda Airport, where the Satos and their jet awaited. Corwin watched them go, then sighed. "Well," he said, "I guess we might as well try to get some sleep." With murmured agreements, the rest of the little group gathered up their things, and they all headed toward the keep. Friday, June 25th. Tenzin Republic City International Airport, Republic City. For her part, Cora also got a bit of sleep on the flight back to Republic City. Not much, and none of it particularly sound, but the Sato's private jet was certainly comfortable enough, and there was little enough else she could do during the flight. The return trip was considerably shorter than the one down, however. With the Avatar aboard, a genuine emergency afoot, and the flight mostly over water, Ryo felt free to disregard all the usual constraints placed on the speed of private flights, and when properly motivated, a future industry's Model 265 could get a serious move on. Even if Cora had been able to go instantly to sleep and stay that way for the whole trip, it would hardly have qualified as more than a fairly long nap. Even so, she could tell at a glance as she disembarked from the jet that she felt fresher than Inspector Imanishi did. It felt odd to see him dressed in tactical armor. Even on some raids, he tended to wear his trademark gray raincoat, since at his age and rank, he was rarely among the people actually kicking down doors and barging into unsecured rooms anymore. Today, though, he had on the full kit, and as he crossed the tarmac to meet Cora, he moved as though he'd been wearing it for a good long time. Itaru, said Korra. What's the latest? The situation's mostly contained, but there's still a lot of tension in the air, Imanishi replied, falling into step with her as she made for the terminal. Behind, the Satos turned their aircraft over to the company ground crew, then ran to catch up. Were you able to convince the president not to send in the army? Korra asked. I didn't have to, the inspector said. Kao mobilized the IDRA, which automatically precluded the United Forces. Korra smiled slightly. Nice. She made a mental note to congratulate Kao, the head of the International Disaster Response Agency, for her quick thinking when she saw her. The clause of the IDRA's charter that excluded armed military forces from areas where the agency was operating was meant to work the other way around, preventing the agency's personnel from going into active conflict zones, but it worked just as well to keep the army out of an area where their presence would just make things worse. Between them, the fire department, the Little Water Tribe militia, and the triples, we've been able to keep the situation controlled without it blowing out into a full-scale civic emergency, but it's been tight, Imanishi continued. I've got everybody in uniform, even the office staff. If anybody wanted to help themselves to everything in police headquarters, they could probably get away with it right now, he added with a tired grin. We've also had some unexpected help from our big universe allies. Eh? Korra wondered. But a moment later, as she and the others entered the terminal building, she had her answer. There was a group of uniformed personnel, mostly cops, but also members of all the other agencies Imanishi had named, gathered on the concourse, getting a little much-needed-looking rest and having a hot beverage. Among them was the colorful figure of Utena's friend Wakaba, who looked like she'd had a bit of a day so far as well. At the sight of the Avatar and her party entering the building, she and Emily Wong broke away from the group and walked toward them, each carrying a cup of tea. Lensman Shinohara has been a great help to us, Imanishi said, as has Miss Wong. Do what you can is kind of implied in the job description when you're in my line of work, said Wakabo with a wry smile. Then, becoming more serious, she went on, I heard from Utena what went down in Nanisevic last night. Thanks for looking after them. Could you use a little extra firepower for the big raid I'm not supposed to have heard about? Korra laughed for the first time in a while. I sure could, she said. Fort Tonrock. The atmosphere in Fort Tonrock was a bit tense, but as they ate lunch, the fort's guests couldn't really say it was surprising. After all, the authorities in Nanisevic were still cleaning up after the riot, and it wasn't at all clear where those participants in it who had escaped had gone. Back to Republic City was the prevailing guess, but it was only a guess, and with that unresolved, and Korra back in the city herself and heading into certain but indeterminate danger, the White Lotus staff at her polar redoubt were understandably a bit tense. The observance of Corwin's birthday, held in the compound's main dining room, was a bit muted by the circumstances, but he didn't mind. He was too preoccupied right now to enjoy the occasion fully anyway. Once the situation was stabilized, he fully intended to live it up, either here or, for preference, back at Bellhaven. If that meant delaying the full festivities until a day or three after his actual birthday, he was fine with that. It's just a box on the calendar, after all, Anthy said, smiling, and Corwin gave her a speculative little smile, since he hadn't said any of the things leading up to it out loud. I know Korra figured it was the best thing under the circumstances, Caitlin mused, gazing out a window at the broad, torch-lit expanse of the central courtyard, once the young Avatar Korra's proving ground and still dotted here and there with obstacles and training equipment. But I'll be just as happy to get the all clear and get out of here. This place doesn't feel like a sanctuary to me. She turned her head, giving Utena a serious, you-feel-it-too sort of look, and went on. It feels like a prison. That's because it is one, Utrinna didn't say aloud. It wasn't the time to be recounting the story of Korra's life, but she knew the Avatar had fully felt the irony of recommending that her friends take temporary shelter in a place where she had effectively been incarcerated, for her safety, from the ages of 4 to 17. Besides, the situation wasn't really the same. Korra hadn't realized she was a prisoner, or her custodians really captors, albeit well-meaning ones, for many years, and when that realization had come, she'd wasted little time in engineering her escape. Utrinna and her family and friends knew well why they were here, and if the Fancy took them to change the plan and leave, it wasn't as if the White Lotus Society were going to try to stop them. As she had the thought, Utrinna felt a subtle shift in something. The Force, maybe, if you credited some Jedi Master's belief that, consciously or not, she was their colleague. Or maybe she had just spent enough time training and talking with Caitlin that she had developed something like Samurai Zanshin. Or maybe they were the same thing. Whatever the case, the tension she'd been feeling in the air all day had just changed. It wasn't a sensation that had any proper analog in physical experience, but the psychological flavor of it brought to mind words like darkened or soured or maybe curdled. Somewhere nearby, or perhaps all around, something was starting to go wrong. She glanced at Kate and saw that her best friend also felt it. So too did Anthy. Utrinna could tell that much just from the slight tightening in the planes of her face. A moment later, Corwin picked up on it as well. "Do you hear that?" Nima asked, tilting her head with a thoughtful frown. "No, but I see it," said Garnet. The little dragon was perched on Caitlin's shoulder, looking out the same window, and she went on with a puzzled look. "Either it's Fight Club Friday for the local White Lotus boys and girls, or something just kicked off big time in the courtyard." Nima rose smoothly to her feet, unconsciously dusting down her robes with puffs of bent air. "I'll go and find out what's going on," she said, but before she could cross to the door, it opened. 2 dozen men and women entered, dressed not in the formal, courtly White Lotus robes they'd all seen on the staff upon arriving, but rather the more pragmatic, abbreviated tactical costume they adopted when action was expected. From their badges, about half were benders, more or less evenly distributed between the three most common disciplines. And in the lead was Master Chung, said Caitlin in mild surprise. "What's going on? Is there some problem?" Tall, bald, ascetic Chiang, Korra's press relations liaison in the society, and one of the relatively few other White Lotus masters Caitlin had met since her own elevation to that office, shook his head gravely. "No, Master Caitlin, or at least I hope there won't be," he replied. As he spoke, the uniformed guards fanned out and surrounded the table, and those seated and standing around it. They looked grim, a few of them a little bit scared, but all determined, and not one of them looked in any way friendly. "Let's all be calm, if you please," Chong went on. "I hope to avoid further violence today, if at all possible." Corwin rose to his feet, moving so abruptly that he startled the White Lotus troops nearest him back a step, and demanded, "What the hell is this, Chong?" "Some people from your own reality are coming to speak with you, Outworlder," Chong replied, his voice colder than the young Ys had known it. "These men and women are here to ensure that you all remain here to be consulted." Before anyone could ask him to elaborate on that, another White Lotus guard entered the room, stopped at the bald master's elbow, and said in a deferential tone, "Master Chong, the representatives of the Black Rose have arrived." As Chong nodded in acknowledgement of the news, Utrinna, Corwin, and Nima drew instinctively closer together, backing up a little and moving so as to place themselves as much as possible between Anthy, or more accurately, Annabelle, and everyone else. Garnet darted from Kate's shoulder to Anthy's, then took up her customary station amid the baby's swaddling. Neri got to her feet, growling softly as she picked up on the sudden spike of tension in the room, but even a soft growl from a full-grown polar bear dog was enough to make a few of the White Lotus guards draw back a little. Meanwhile, Caitlin stayed where she was by the window, but her body language was not that of someone who felt hemmed in by the burly presences of uniformed guards in her space. At the other end of the table, Maki shifted in her chair, not trying to rise but adjusting her weight preparatory to it. Lying by Kate's feet, Sergei made no sound, just gazed at Chiang with steady, strangely knowing eyes. "Good," said Chiang. "Open the gates and make them welcome. Let's get this over with." Turning his attention to the increasingly hostile guests, he added, "Master Caitlin, I know better than to ask this of you, but I trust, Master Nima, that you are prepared to honor your oath as a master of the White Lotus Society." "I fail to see how this course of action accords with that oath, Master Chiang," Nima replied with such perfect, mature cordiality that even Corwin, feeling the jaws of a trap closing around him and his family, had to smile just a little. "You guys work for Korra, don't you?" Garnet put in, then added with a sarcastic uncertainty, "I'm no expert, but I'm reasonably sure she doesn't want you to be doing anything anyone from the Black Rose would be asking for." "What Avatar Korra wants and what she needs are often two very different things, Master Dragon," Chiang told her. "I am sworn to see to the latter." With a sharp glance at Corwin and his family, he added, "Not the former." "That's about the most presumptuous thing I've ever heard," Utina shot back. "And that's saying something, believe me. She's got to be nigh on 100 years older than you." "The Avatar is an overgrown child, whatever her count of years," Chiang replied flatly. "I don't know why, I'm not a metaphysician. Perhaps some lingering effect of what she endured during the harmonic convergence so many years ago. But while she has lived for nearly 14 decades now, she has never grown up. And after working closely with her for nearly two of those decades, I am convinced that she never will. It's hard enough to keep her focused on her purpose at the best of times, and you people are a dangerous distraction, a shiny object. As such, I've concluded that it's my sworn duty as a White Lotus Master to see that you are removed, since you seem to have lost any inclination to return to your place of origin of your own accord." "You son of a—" Corwin began, but Chiang cut him off, saying in a louder tone of voice, "I have firm assurances that you will not be harmed, only compelled to leave this world and not return. So if you will all kindly sit down and act like civilized beings, we can still avoid an unpleasant scene." Caitlin turned her head and looked out the window again. At this distance, a good 200 yards out in the dark, she could more sense the gates opening than actually see them, and the figures waiting outside them. "What do you say, Utina?" she asked, sounding strangely casual. "Want to be a good girl and do as you're told for once in your life?" Utina frowned thoughtfully. She said, as if giving the idea all due consideration. Then, with a suddenness that took all those around her by surprise, she turned, the prince's epaulets and petticoat appearing on her water tribe fighting anorak, and punched the man nearest to her so hard in the face that she left a permanent impression of her rose seal on his jaw. Burly, well-conditioned earthbender or not, he went down like a dropped sack of potatoes, with a heavy thud and not so much as a whimper. "Not really," said Utina, and the room erupted into mayhem. A few minutes ago, Republic City. The first stage of the raid went off like clockwork, which was Cora's first clue that something was wrong. Raids this big never went completely as expected. There was always something, usually right at the outset, that threw at least part of the plan out the window and required some improvisation to get the thing back on track. This being the biggest one to date, possibly the biggest and last one of the whole operation if their intel was correct, she was expecting more than the usual share of bank shots, not less. Doubly so because, thanks to the timing of the main target's arrival, it had to be a daylight raid, conducted when the opposition would be at its most alert. And yet, nothing of the kind had happened. Surprise was near total. Cora and the task force's heaviest hitters, the boys and girls of the Special Tactical Division, piled out of the trucks and hit the fortified doors of the dockside warehouse all but unopposed. Only when the doors were down and the tactical troopers flooding into the building did the startled red monsoons within realize anything was amiss. Ironically, given that the Avatar was the only waterbender among them, the RCPD's forces rolled over the monsoons like a tsunami, flattening their uncoordinated defense with precision teamwork and mutual support. Cora hardly had to do anything as the Special Division rolled up the Triad defenders and secured the premises. "I have to be honest, that was a little bit anticlimactic," said Emily Wong wryly as she walked with Cora toward the very back of the building, where the tactical personnel had the entrance to an enclosed office area surrounded. Like everyone else participating in the raid, Emily was dressed in a suit of police-issue metalbender armor. But like Cora's, the reporter's was a color other than police green, and bore no insignia or official markings. Where Cora's was a dark, Water Tribe-inspired blue and entirely unmarked, Emily's was plain bare metal gray and emblazoned with "Press" in large white characters on breastplate and back. "It's not over yet," said Cora, not looking at Emily. She looked and sounded tense, almost edgy, not a state she'd been in for any of the other raids Emily had accompanied her and the task force on thus far. She was looking around the cavernous room that was most of the building, her eyes darting from corner to corner, a look of deep but uncertain suspicion on her face. "Keep your guard up," the Avatar went on. "This was too easy. I don't like it." Emily might have made a joke about the task force simply being too much for the monsoons to handle, but the look on Cora's face as she spoke was enough to quash any levity the young reporter might have felt. The Avatar's tension was enough to put Emily's nerves back on alert as well. They arrived at the heavy, reinforced metal door barring the way into the office area. "What have we got?" Cora asked. Inspector Imanishi turned from his examination of the door and gave her a wry little smile, though underneath it, Emily noticed that he, too, looked wary. "The usual," Imanishi replied, gesturing to the door. Cora stepped up and placed her fingertips thoughtfully against it, tapping gently. Then, in spite of her lingering unease, chuckled darkly. "Platinum," she said. "They always think this'll help." "Maybe they think you're a werewolf," Imanishi remarked dryly. "Maybe," Cora said. "Okay, everybody, stand back." As the cops and Emily retired to a safe distance, she stood before the door for a moment, gathering herself, then set to work. The wisdom, if you wanted to call it that, behind building really important things out of platinum could be traced back to the Equalist Rebellion of 171, the very first incident Cora had had to deal with in her career as a public figure. Back then, a particularly vicious and inventive non-bender with a grudge had figured out that highly refined metals like jewelry-grade platinum resisted metal bending, because metal bending wasn't really metal bending. It was bending the little bits of earth left behind in ordinary commercial-grade metals. Hiroshi Sato's platinum-hulled mecha tanks had wreaked havoc with the RCPD's early tinheads, and Cora, who hadn't even been a metalbender at the time, before they'd figured out other ways of dealing with them. Since then, Copycats galore had latched onto the platinum trick, building elaborately expensive lockboxes, fortifications, and restraints out of this stuff in a succession of attempts to keep metalbenders, particularly Korra, away from things or subdued, depending on the circumstances. Few of those later adopters really understood why the original version of the trick had worked, though, and this door was a perfect example. It looked and felt like solid platinum, and so must have represented a very significant investment on the part of the Red Monsoon bosses who had ordered it put in place, and it was set in an ordinary reinforced concrete wall and floor. She didn't even have to go into the Avatar state to rip it from its moorings and fling it halfway back to the street. She didn't really need to do the second part, she could have just dropped it where it was, but Korra had long believed that in her position, sometimes you just had to make a statement. Beyond the jagged hole in the wall where the platinum door had stood was an office, oddly well decorated given its overall setting. In it, a startled-looking group of Red Monsoon gang members stood in a defensive formation around a large, ornate desk. Behind it sat a man in very expensive clothes that had a strong flavor of the water tribes about them, but for their vivid red color. His face was lined and weather-beaten, and his long, intricately braided hair was white, but he was broad-shouldered and square-jawed, and as he rose to his feet to greet his guests, he moved with an unhurried smoothness that belied his apparent age. "I've been expecting you, kinswoman," he said, his voice calm and rich. "I'm no kinswoman of yours, Nanutak," Korra replied shortly. "Save your charm for people who have time for it." "You're a descendant of Chief Harnuk, are you not?" Nanutak observed, unperturbed. "So am I." "What you are is under arrest," said Imanishi, brusquely ignoring the Triad leader's efforts to needle the Avatar. If the prospect bothered Nanutak at all, he showed no sign of it. He merely took an elaborate pocket watch from his fur-trimmed waistcoat, opened it, and considered its face for a moment, then closed the case and returned it to its pocket with a bland smile. "I think not, Inspector," he said. "Sir," cried one of the uniformed officers out in the main room. "Trouble!" "On the plus side," said Nanutak pleasantly as he uncorked the water skin he wore at his waist, "this does confirm your theory about cooperation between my organization and the Agni Kai." And then the firebenders burst into the warehouse through every window and skylight, the Red Monsoon leader overturned his desk, and generally all hell broke loose. "Sometimes I hate it when I'm right," Korra grumbled to Emily as she and the reporter dove for cover together. Fort Tonrock. Nima turned, looking around the room as the dust settled. Chong and a set of his traitor Lotus guards had bolted within seconds of Utina decking one of their captors, but between her skills as master airbender, Corwin's earthbending, and Utina and Caitlin's long experience in fighting a roomful of mooks, they had the remaining turncoats handled within minutes. "Is that it?" "Why do we never get to have nice, normal birthdays?" Corwin wondered as he began breaking down a barrier that one of Chong's earthbenders had used to block the door. "All I wanted was a nice quiet day with my friends and family. Maybe some cake. Possibly bowling." Caitlin re-sheathed her Zatoichi, then shrugged. "Jury took me out to the Black Angus for mine." Finally clearing the door, then shattering the lock with a sharp blow from Stick, Corwin gave a mirthless chuckle, clearly bantering to keep himself from becoming livid with rage. "I guess that's the solution. Next year, we'll just go to the Sizzler." "Duly noted," Utina observed, before helping make sure that Annabelle's wrap was secured as snugly as possible to Enthi's chest. "Do you think we can get out of here if we make it upstairs?" Corwin shrugged. "Depends how many of the garrison are on our side. We might be able to hold out. This place is a fortress. Failing that, yeah, if we can get to Vayu, we can probably make it to Senna or Nani. Or the Southern Air Temple, Nima pointed out. From what we saw earlier, Maki observed as they swept into the hallway, I think there's a significant force here who are still loyal to Korra, but if what Chong said is true, he may have reinforcements here soon. Utrina couldn't help but admire the way that Maki was getting her game face makeup on as they were making their escape. Filing that under slightly amusing amid this torrent of crap, she tried to visualize what they were walking into. If we can give that bunch in the courtyard a hand, that'll let us shut the gates again. If we're lucky, we can trap Chong's people outside and give us some breathing room. And at the worst, Nima said, we'll force anyone on the outside to deal with that before trying to help their allies. When they reached the doorway that led into the courtyard, Utrina raised a hand to hold everyone up, then carefully opened one of the heavy wooden doors enough to get a quick look. From the citadel's high vantage point, it was easy to see where a small group, almost certainly Chong and his bodyguards, were heading for the main gates, while a group that probably numbered 20 or so was holding another dozen in a small knot against the wall nearest to the citadel steps. Looks like they've got the people who are still on our side outnumbered about 2-1, and Chong's making for the gate. Gorwin nodded, then tapped his fingers thoughtfully along Stick's ferrule. How do you want to play this? You, Maki, and Kate go spring the good guys, Utrina ordered, pointing at each person as she named them. Nima, Anthy, and I'll cut Chong off. Don't leave me out, Garnet interrupted. Of course, Utrina corrected herself. You're the air support. Damn right I am. Even as the Trinity prepared their breakout, the gates of the compound opened. Toga Kiryu smiled as the heavy doors slowly ground open, revealing the complex to his small entourage. For once, things were going exactly as planned. As the doors came to a halt, the liaison he'd been told to expect arrived, a pair of solid-looking guards with him. Taking a step away from the guards, the bald man in the dark blue suit bowed. Mr. Kuruta, welcome to Fort Tonrock. Toga stepped forward, returning the bow. A pleasure to be here, Master Chong. I trust things went smoothly. Chong had a good poker face, but Toga's senses were attuned to more than just physical cues. It wasn't difficult to detect the undercurrent of tension despite the Master Lotus's polished calm. It was less than ideal, but they have been contained. As if their targets had heard that, the doors to the elevated keep at the back of the compound suddenly blasted outward on a column of compressed air, followed by an unmistakably pink-haired woman leading a charge of figures down the white stone steps. Toga's smirk turned into a scowl for a moment. Then he brought his expression under control with an effort of will. After all, he was the one with the edge here. Perhaps not, Master Lotus. Ah, well, that's why we keep our options open. And then, to Chong's considerable surprise, the man he knew as Mr. Kuroda and the small figure standing behind him both disappeared. It's so hard to get good help, Toga mused, turning away from the viewscreen. Addressing the diminutive, pale-haired woman who stood next to his command chair, he went on in a languid tone of voice that nevertheless carried an edge of authority. Time to call out the troops, baby. Contingency white. Surface the ship. Yes, sir, she replied quietly. As the deck took on a distinct up-angle beneath their feet, her eyes went far away, as if she were communicating through an implant, or perhaps telepathy. Six people, plus one infant, two pets, and one quite tiny dragon, weren't exactly an overwhelming force, particularly when they broke into two groups of four, but striking an unprepared opponent helped. Plus, The Trinity and their friends were quite capable of punching above their weight, particularly when the pets in question were a Siberian tiger and a full-grown polar bear dog. Using the shock of Nima demolishing the doors to distract the turncoat guards, Utrina's team rushed straight past them, charging toward the other end of the courtyard, while Corwin's group went straight up the middle. The traitor guards seemed mostly to be earthbenders, while the hair and dress of the loyalists marked most of them as members of the water tribes. That didn't surprise Corwin much. After all, many of them had ties of family to Korra, not just organizational allegiance. As Caitlin and Maki began to engage their opponents, he realized they hadn't heard from or seen Izumi. He knew a Kyoshi warrior wasn't likely to have joined Chiang's revolt, but was she imprisoned? Injured? Worse? His answer came when the younger warrior, dressed in her full tactical gear, seemingly teleported into the midst of the melee, flinging throwing irons at the traitors from each hand. "Well, okay, there's that mystery solved," he thought wryly. As she ran for the gates with Anthy and Utrina, Nima quickly realized that trying to slam the compound doors would be asking a lot even for a master airbender. Instead, she went for the more expedient method of clearing Chiang and the interlopers from the big universe out of the way with a concussive blast of air that blew them all clean out of the gateway, knocking several of them end over end back toward the path that led down to the harbor. With that done, all Utrina had to do to close the gates was yank the large red handle that worked the motorized doors, followed by slashing the heavy gauge cable that ran from the control box once they had shut. Anthy gave a slight at that solution, but Utrina simply shrugged. "Corwin can fix it after we're done here. Come on, I want to get a better look at what we're up against." Double-timing her way up to the observation post at the top of the wall, Utrina didn't wait for Anthy or Nima to follow. Instead, she took advantage of the polar aurora to get a good look at the glacial shelf and harbor below. It was slightly dimmer than day at this time of year, but she could easily make out the black-clad figures that were regrouping outside the fort. Focusing on her lens, she called, "Corwin, we've got the front door taken care of, but it looks like some of the Black Rose reinforcements are heading around to the other side of the ice pack." She could feel him frown through the lens contact, then his "aha" moment. "I'm betting they're going for the fjordside boat dock. The postern's one of the only other weak points in these walls." "Get over there and let me know what's going on as soon as you can," Utrina told him. "I'm going to keep an eye on the ones who are still hanging around the front door." "Roger that, I'm on my way," he replied, then added wryly, "I love it when you boss me around." The response that received included no concepts readily translated into words, but they made Corwin grin slightly, even under the circumstances, as he beat it for the postern gate. Southern Ice Pack, 1/3 mile from Fort Tonrock. Anubishu had decided some time ago that he hated this pathetic little world, and a week of hard camping on the ice had done nothing to change his mind. Infiltration had been simple enough. After leaving Orophos, the Masho had returned to Kaneko to train for this operation, escalating to almost a month of cold-weather survival training in Ishiyama's polar regions, after being given a briefing on where their targets would most likely seek shelter. Zipang was a Federation member, and even though Ishiyama was not part of that body, the planet's governments both maintained trade relations with it. Visas stating that the four men were visiting Zipang on business weren't even technically inaccurate. Once they'd reached Saikyo, the Black Rose's local assistants had provided train tickets that led them into Dicho. While Rajara had taken his usual delight in acquiring the camping and cold-weather gear they required through, in the Masho leader's opinion, a needlessly complex series of cutouts and shell companies. From there, they'd traveled on several prearranged berths by train or ship until their final leg, where one of the White Lotus Society's own supply vessels was ordered to pause en route to Fort Tonrock just long enough to let the four guests depart on an inflatable boat. He'd been told by Otori that it was entirely possible the Macho would not need to reveal themselves, but in truth, Anubishu hoped that would not be the case. After all they'd gone through to prepare, he dearly wanted to hit someone. He had no problems with cold weather as such. He had grown up dealing with it. But getting Naza to do anything at all in such conditions was an exercise in controlled fury, and Shuten complained about the weather silently but eloquently. His every gesture was one of disgust, and Anubishu had to control his desire to beat the boy bloody. The whole affair had rather strained the Macho leader's patience, and he had never possessed a surplus of that to begin with. A few minutes after 0 hour, the holocom unit he'd smuggled in sounded for his attention, and the other three Macho assembled around him as their leader opened the channel, displaying a young woman's head and shoulders in midair. "Attention. Captain Kiryu has declared contingency white. Proceed as planned." Snapping the comm shut, Anubishu's eyes glittered with anticipation in the polar twilight. "At last. Macho! For Kaneko's honor and Yamao's memory, we strike!" Fort Tonrock. Corwin Ravenhair's eyes opened as he came out of his brief lens conversation with his wife, then looked over to where Maki and Izumi were helping to secure the mostly unconscious traitors with the help of the loyal Lotus members. "Maki," he called, "I'm heading to the postern. It looks like they may be trying the boat dock. See if there are any earthbenders left we can trust and send them after me as soon as you can." Double-timing up the steps to the citadel, he hung a left, then made his way up the stairs to the guard shack overseeing the boat dock from the top of the fortress wall. What he found when he reached the top was so incredibly out of place that Corwin had to stop for a moment and just try to make sense of it. "Ujna? Yes?" "There's a submarine here," said Corwin, his tone of psychic voice oddly conversational. "What?" "There's a submarine here," Corwin repeated. "If you want to be technically precise, a Japanese Sentoku-class submarine aircraft carrier, circa 1945. A moment's pause. "Are you sure?" "Remember who you're talking to," Corwin thought wryly. "Anyway, the class of the sub is neither here nor there at the moment. What's important is they've sailed up the fjord, surfaced through the ice at the boat dock, and now they're putting people ashore." "Okay," Utrina replied, sounding mystified. "Well, I guess we can figure that out later, too." With the still loyal White Lotus Earthbenders concentrating on protecting the wall from their traitorous former colleagues, Corwin was free to take a broader tactical view, trying to figure out what the enemy was up to. Assaulting the postern gate by the boat dock was a valid strategy. It was smaller and could be assumed to be less heavily fortified than the main gate out front. But the force now crossing the ice from that submarine was too small to pose a serious threat, even to a smaller gate if the defenders on the inside were dug in well enough. Even as a diversionary force, there weren't enough of them. His eyes narrowed as he recognized the figure in the lead of that group, then went wide with surprise as he caught sight of the person next to him. Toga Kiryu's presence here was not entirely unexpected. Corwin already knew from Cheong's incautious subordinate that the Order of the Black Rose was behind this assault somehow, and spotting the red-headed fallen duelist in the flanking force's van was unsurprising confirmation of that fact. But the small figure next to him, regarding the scene expressionlessly, that individual Corwin was not expecting to see. "It's the girl I saw in Nanisevik," he realized, his confusion only deepening. What the hell? An alarm bell started jingling in the back of his mind, but before he could concentrate enough to figure out what, specifically, was causing it, one of the loyal Lotus Earthbenders cried, "Sir, the enemy Earthbenders are shifting their focus. They're leaving off trying to pull down the wall." Corwin had already felt that. Like the man who had spoken, he was standing on the wall and had felt the enemy's insistent tugging at its structure cease. Brow furrowing, he tried to sense what else they might be up to. Tunneling underneath, perhaps? But the frozen nature of the ground made it difficult to sense, particularly with his heavy winter boots on. Before he could bring his full focus to bear on that, in turn, an urgent lens contact from Uchna at the main gate spun his thoughts in a new direction. "Corwin, I recognize the leader of the main attacking force. It's General Anubishu." Corwin blinked, surprised once again. "From Ishiyama? Leader of the Kaneko Imperial Musho? What the hell is he doing here?" "I don't know," Uchna replied, "but the others are with him. I recognize them from the Christmas 06 after-action report. Rajara, Naza, and some new guy in the armor of the one Kate killed back then." "Oh, this just keeps getting better and better," said Corwin. "The captain of our mystery submarine appears to be Toga. Are the Musho and the Agni Kai working for Akio now? What the hell is going on?" Uchna knew the question was rhetorical and didn't bother trying to answer it, just sent him a wordless combination of encouragement and assurance that she'd do her best, then broke the connection to concentrate on what she was doing. For his part, Corwin's mind was starting to reel, too many unexpected circumstances cropping up too quickly for him to maintain a proper overview of the situation. The wild cards and random factors were starting to pile up faster than he could process them, throwing him off balance, and he felt something rather like the tickling start of panic rising somewhere in the back of his mind. This was no random act of violence, nor a show of force directed against Korra's friends by her enemies for her benefit. These people, whoever and whatever had induced them to work together, and there could be little enough question about that, were here for them. He was snapped away from that reverie in turn by the muted sensation of the ground buckling a short distance from the wall. For a second he thought his earlier surmise had been right. The enemy's earthbenders were trying to tunnel under the wall, but then he saw that they weren't. They were collapsing the ground outside, just beyond the point where the defender's dogged grip on the substance of the wall itself ended. As Corwin watched, the dozen or so earthbenders among the White Lotus traitors opened a deep trench in the ground, from the wall right down to the boat dock, through the quay wall and into the basin, at which point a group of red-jacketed people at the back of the flanking force started to make the distinctive gestures of waterbending, helping the frigid waters of the basin flood the newly dug canal even faster. "Red monsoons!" cried the nearest of the defenders, belatedly recognizing the enemy waterbender's clothes. "What are they doing here?" "Your guess is as good as mine, pal," Corwin thought absently, doubling his efforts to get a mental handle on the situation. How did the attackers expect opening a waterway to the wall to help them? The enemy waterbenders could try to get some kind of hydraulic hammer thing going, he supposed, but with the defenders still in firm control of the wall itself, that wasn't going to get them anywhere. Besides, many of the remaining loyalists were locals. That handful of monsoons wasn't going to win a waterbending fight here in the South Pole. Time seemed to stretch as he applied all his concentration to the problem. There was a key here somewhere, he could feel it, somewhere amid these jumbled, scattered, seemingly unconnected elements that somehow made up the attacking force. Toga pointed at the wall, and the silver-haired girl, her face still all but blank, nodded, her odd sea-green eyes narrowing slightly. The rest of the flanking force was tense, their body language expectant, almost gleeful. but they seem to be hanging back slightly, as if reluctant to approach too closely. A half mile down the fjord, the angular white shape of a Southern Water Tribe Navy ice-breaking destroyer hove into view, smashing its way around the bend that led down to the sea. As soon as it cleared the headland, its forward gun turret barked, spitting a 5-inch shell. The first shot went long, blasting a crater in the ice beyond the attacker's submarine and throwing up a huge spraying cloud of ice crystals. The second was short, opening another hole between the sub and her attacker. The destroyer's gun crew, working their turret with commendable efficiency, got off a third shot within only a few seconds, and this one would have been a direct hit, the motionless submarine a literally sitting target. The shell struck thin air as if it had hit an armored wall, a few yards short along a trajectory that would have taken it straight into the submarine's starboard flank amidships. Hexagonal patterns of light strobed in the air at the point of non-impact, momentarily illuminating the curvature of an otherwise invisible bubble of clear space around the vessel. And suddenly Corwin knew why the attackers had a World War II vintage Japanese submarine, and why they wanted a water course leading to the side of the fortress. Time snapped back to its normal rate, in fact, began to feel as if it were passing slightly faster than normal, as things began happening almost on top of each other. "Get back!" Corwin roared to the defenders near him, gesturing. "Get away from the wall!" Some heard and obeyed, picking up on the sudden, terrible urgency in his voice. Abandoning their posts, they scrambled for the nearest ladders or made emergency stairs or slides for themselves. Others either didn't hear him or chose to disregard the instruction, remaining at their stations with a grim determination that he would otherwise have found admirable. Cursing, he stamped a foot on the stone rampart, not in frustration, but to command it. Tilting, the formerly horizontal surface sprang several inches inward, catapulting the people standing on it into the compound's courtyard. They would be bruised, some might have bones broken, but they would survive the fall. And they would, Corwin knew with a sick certainty, not have survived what was going to happen next. Gathering himself, he followed them, throwing himself into the courtyard. He hit the ground hard, rolled to a stop, pushed himself up on one elbow to look back. At a 40-foot section of the wall, he and the others had just been defending went away. It didn't explode or collapse, wasn't torn open or pulled down by unresisted enemy earthbending. Rather, it was swallowed up by a sphere of brutally brilliant scarlet light that sprang into existence from somewhere just below its base. Corwin had only seen the effect in ancient videos, hastily and imperfectly shot centuries before he was born, but he recognized it instantly. It was cold, hard confirmation of the horrible understanding that had settled on his heart when he saw the scintillating hexagons of what was unmistakably a Klein field, protecting what looked like a World War II submarine from the gunfire of a modern Water Tribe destroyer, the detonation of a spatial corrosion warhead, the signature weapon of the Fleet of Fog. Black-edged and shivering with eerie unreality, it crackled in place for a few seconds, then fell in on itself and disappeared, leaving behind a curved-edged hole in the wall through which first water from the impromptu canal, and then black and red-clad invaders, poured. Even as he dragged himself painfully to his feet and prepared to give them battle, Corwin raced through everything he knew about the fog in his mind. It wasn't much, not because it was an area of study he had neglected, but because nobody knew much about the Fleet of Fog. They were a force of unmanned sea vessels, visually identical to ocean-going combatants of Earth's Second World War, who had appeared out of nowhere on that planet in the early 21st century and prevented all use of the world's oceans and intercontinental airspace for 3 decades. Not even the WDF had been able to figure out a way to shift them without causing a devastating global war, which they had been unwilling to do. The lockdown hadn't extended to off-planet flights, and so had prompted the second Earth diaspora. And then, as suddenly and mysteriously as they came, the fog disappeared. No one had ever been able to find out where they went, or why, or what they had been or wanted in the first place. All that was known for sure was that they had possessed some very distinctive technologies, most prominently among them their Kleinfield protective systems, centuries ahead of their time, and the corrosive torpedo, still never duplicated, both of which Corwin had just seen in action, deployed at the unlikely behest of Toga Kiryu. The girl, Corwin realized as he saw the small, still expressionless figure enter the compound next to Toga. She's the key. She's controlling the submarine somehow. No. He looked more closely, concentrating, and saw her through eyes more consciously attuned to his province as the Norse god of Mecca. Not a girl, not in the biological sense, but an automaton, a fiendishly complicated assemblage of tailored nanomachines, configured to resemble an adolescent human female in virtually every imaginable respect. But at the core of her, hidden from ordinary view but plain to his divinely extended senses, a beating core of something, its influence rippling outward to control the billions of nanites that made up the girl shape, and the trillions more that made up the naval vessel. She is the submarine, he realized. Missiles began raining down on the breached compound, blasting outbuildings and scattering the defenders still further. Now that the girl who was somehow the core of the submarine could see what lay within and target her ship body's vertical launch systems accurately. The red monsoons and Toga's black-clad followers took advantage of the confusion to press their attack, which rapidly started looking something like a rout. Maki! Izumi! Corwin cried, and instantly, even in this chaos, the two green-clad Kyoshi warriors appeared at his sides. Cover me! Keep Toga off me! I have to do something about that submarine before we're all killed! Understood, said Maki, her face grim under the fierce face paint. She closed the fan in her left hand, turning it around so that she held it like a reversed tactical baton, and opened her mini-shield on that forearm. Go! Be careful, Corwin had just enough time to tell them, and then he was running flat out across the courtyard toward the breach with the two of them in echelon to either side. A few of the black-clad attackers. Geez, they're just kids, what the hell? Some part of Corwin thought distractedly. Tried to intercept him, but he swept them aside with stick, or evaded them, or left them for Maki and Izumi to deal with, as he bore down on Toga and his petite companion. The girl noticed him a split second before Toga did, but didn't seem to know what to make of his headlong charge toward her. She drew back slightly, the first flicker of emotion, faint surprise, crossing her face. Toga's triumphant smirk became a sneer as he drew his lightsaber and moved to intercept him. The Kyoshi warriors hit him high and low, Izumi taking his legs in a flying tackle, while Maki deftly avoided his lightsaber and smashed her buckler into his face. And he lurched out of Corwin's narrowing field of view an instant before he hit the girl, shoulder low, bull-rushing her back through the breach in the wall by main force. She recovered quickly, getting her feet back under her a few yards beyond the breach, and Corwin discovered, not altogether to his surprise, that she was fantastically strong. Without apparent effort, she straight-armed him, bringing his charge up short, and then flung him to the side, nearly sending him tumbling into the canal, before he could catch himself on stick and lever himself back the other way. "Who are you?" he asked her, a faintly eldritch edge coming into his voice as he addressed, in effect, one of the subjects of his divine rule. The silver-haired girl made that faintly surprised face again, there and gone in a half-second, then said tonelessly, "I am long-range submarine I-401. I am Captain Kiryu's ship." "Why is the fleet of fog working for the Order of the Black Rose?" Corwin demanded. I-401 gave him an uncomprehending look. "The fleet is not involved in this operation," she said. "I am Captain Kiryu's ship."
401, Toga barked from several yards away. "Don't talk to him, just kill him! Arr!"
He cut himself off, as Maki capitalized on his distraction and nearly gutted him with one razor-edged fan.
"Aye, aye, Captain," 401 replied, still without evident emotion.
And then, with no personal animus but intense mechanical concentration, she did her best to follow his orders. She was fast, she was strong, she was machine precise. She could do something very interesting with zero-point energy, and she could make missiles fall from the sky. But by this point, Corwin was furious, his mind racing and blood boiling. Exerting himself to the fullest, he was able to stay a half-step ahead of her, staying alive while she laid waste to the boat dock and outer battlements trying to eliminate him. At one point in the combat, he elicited that look of muted surprise from her again by, acting on instinct without consciously noticing he had done it, batting aside one of her gravity distortions with stick as if it were a rock she'd thrown at him.
"Enough!" he snarled,
planting the staff upright in the snowpack to free his hands. Pointing and exerting all of his will, feeling his Aesir brand burning on his forehead and his Midgard seal vibrating on his earlobe, he froze her in place, overriding every motor impulse in her nanostructure, then seized her by the front of her pea-jacket with his right hand, the fingertips of his left hand against her forehead and face like a Vulcan attempting a mind meld. Even at this point, at this feverish pitch of fury, he didn't want or intend to destroy her. She might be his enemy herself, but equally, she might simply be a puppet of those enemies. Either way, she was a unique and intriguing creature, a mechanism and being he had never encountered before. And she was, in a pure and uncomplicated way, among the most beautiful mechanisms he had ever seen. Destroying such a creation would be vandalism, unforgivable. Blotting the rest of the universe completely from his senses, Corwin hurled his consciousness against hers, the Norse words spilling from his lips without his mind having formed them. "I am Corwin of the Raven Hair, watcher o'er the world engine, chooser of the slain. By my will and by my power as Lord of Great Machines, this is my command!" I-401's sea-green eyes went wide, showing the first complete, unattenuated emotional response he'd seen in them, a sort of infinite reverberating shock.
"Cease!"
Corwin roared, and a wave of brilliant silver light blasted out from the spot where the two of them stood, with a sound like thunder. To Corwin's left, on the fortress side, the shockwave blew attackers and defenders alike off their feet and collapsed a weakened section of the wall. To his right, as it raced across the fjord, it smashed and shattered the ice, splintered the submarine's Kleinfield, and ripped into the sub itself. For an instant, the vessel shimmered, outlined in silver-white lightning, as the command of the Aes of Mecha stripped away every operating instruction in every single one of the trillions of microscopic machines that made up its structure. And then, as every one of them shut down, the whole submarine disintegrated, dissolving into 7,000 tons of inert silver sand that sank to the bottom of Gorluktuk Fjord. For an eternal second, Corwin and the girl that was all that remained of I-401 stood locked together, steam rising from their tattered clothes and Corwin's brand, staring into each other's eyes.
"I didn't know,"
said I-401 in a tiny, barely audible, deeply remorseful voice, and then she and Corwin both crumpled to the ground, unconscious. Toga didn't see exactly what happened to I-401. The two girls in the bizarre clown makeup were keeping him too busy to keep track of other matters. But he gathered Ravenhair had found some way of destroying her. That gave him some cause for concern. Not for the girl. He didn't give a damn about real women,
never mind an imitation as unconvincing and uncooperative as that blank-eyed little doll had been. The submarine had figured pretty large in his escape plan, however, and its loss was, at best, a significant inconvenience. Ah, well, nothing for it but to make some more havoc. That was really his job on this assignment, after all. Neither Maki nor Izumi had ever seen a lightsaber before, but they weren't stupid. They knew nothing that looked and sounded like that was likely to be something to take on with conventional weapons. Instead of engaging him blade to blade, Maki left her sword in its saya and concentrated on the man rather than the weapon. The two Kyoshi warriors chipped away at him, always in motion, trying to stay a step ahead of him. No easy feat, for whoever he might be, he was indisputably a formidable swordsman. Toga wasted a little time trying to deal with both of them at once, then decided that what he really needed to do was take them one at a time. Seeing an opening, he feinted to drive Izumi away, turned, and concentrated on one of the techniques he'd learned from Venger. Marshalling the force, he seized Maki in mid-leap and hurled her away, slamming her into the jagged rubble where part of the breached wall had collapsed. Maki was startled by the maneuver. Having no frame of reference for force telekinesis, she at first had the baffled thought that he was an airbender. Her body armor saved her from serious injury when she hit the rubble, but she was stunned by the impact, then roused back to full consciousness by the sunburst of pain as Toga collapsed more of the compromised stonework upon her, pinning her lower body. "Izumi, get clear!" Maki cried to her younger colleague, pushing ineffectually at the blocks of stone with her hands. "Don't try to take him alone!" But Izumi ignored her, and Maki saw with dawning horror that that was exactly what she intended to do.